Okay, folks, it's September 18th on Saturday, 2021. I'm pushing through some frustration myself. Don't know why, but my 12-year-old, he's very much drawn to the screens, and he gets out and does a lot of cool stuff, but I'm kind of feel like I'm peeling him away from that habit. School has started, COVID is still raging, but the screens are there, and it's a weekend, and we're 3 weeks into school, 2 weeks into school, so that's been frustrating me as a parent. And then that's some of the effects of COVID I can feel of all this, what we've gone through, and then also, like, my practice as a therapist, I've been a little burnt out, just seeing how other people have been affected by all this, you know, our societal troubles and difficulties at this time. And it's made me really want to do something like this podcast, to just word vomit into the microphone and get it out. So yeah, it's a beautiful day, beautiful fall day. It's actually been raining in White Salmon, Washington. We've had a bad dry spell for 6 months and finally got some rain. And that's really good for me, for my self-care, so I can go whitewater kayaking and hopefully ski in a couple months. But anyway, so some of the stuff I'm learning how to get through as a parent with my kid. He's actually a super good kid. It's just difficult. He's got his own mind, so it's difficult. I gotta work with him. So I'm dragging him out to go mountain biking in an hour after he hangs out at his friend's house. Anyway, that's where I'm at. And so this relationship with just all of us, with technology and nature itself, is pretty, I would say, actively at this time for humans, like, is pretty imbalanced. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to see that. And the whole climate change debacle, how everything's just kind of, you know, going away, supposedly. And so we've got that on our minds as a collective, right? Humans. And I've been reading up on some stuff, or just thinking about and listening to podcasts about our relationship to nature and how our society just really kind of doesn't have much of one. And that's most likely the root cause of our issues in our culture, Western culture itself. I don't want to go spouting off a bunch of stuff from other cultures and noble savage myths about, you know, how people used to be and close to the land and how much, you know, supposedly they did have the wisdom for sure. But I'm not a scholar and I'm not an expert on any of that. And I'm just going to refer to a little bit that I do know. And I'll maybe even reference some other people who know more than me. Indigenous scholars in particular are really rad to check out. I would suggest Tyson Yunkaporta. He wrote a book called Sand Talk. He is an Aboriginal man from Australia. And he is an extremely wise person. And I recommend, he's kind of showing up in a lot of podcasts and a lot of discussions around how we need to perceive nature and our relationship to nature. And yeah, it's his book Sand Talk says a lot about it, and it's very in-depth scholarly work. It's not just something I can mention off the cuff, but Tyson Yunkaporta, he's amazing, and he's got a podcast himself. It's called The Other Others. And he interviews people, he interviews various indigenous scholars and just kind of lots of folks, people in the social justice world. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So for me, as Whitey in the United States, you know, the one thing that I can say from my perspective that I need to fix, and, you know, Westerners in general, is our relationship to nature. I mean, my relationship to nature, you know, I go mountain biking, I'm a whitewater kayaker, I live in a beautiful place. I try to leave my yard all natural, which basically means I'm just lazy, too lazy to mow it. I didn't water or have a garden this year, so I was gone. I love to hike. I love to get dirty. my house is not all that clean. So I'd say I kind of try to live in nature, but, you know, that's as much as me as a Westerner I'm going to get for now. But I know there's more I can do. So I've just been thinking, you know, what do I do for my kid? And what else can I do for my clients to help them just... I don't know yet. I have this... I want to teach classes on reciprocity with the earth without sounding like a... this floaty, utopian, idealistic kind of thing. And I'm searching for that. So that will unfold as it does. You know, we'll see. But for now, I live in a rural area. I'll just bring up what I was going to talk about months ago. It's called the reciprocity. It was going to be a reciprocity podcast. So, reciprocity with the earth. Now, I'm going to quote Native American saying that lots of people like to say, Aho Metakwiasin means all my relations. And that's a Lakota saying that people have taken and seem to use a lot. But I think the idea behind it is all my relations, we are related to everything. We are not above everything, but we are with everything. You know, some of what I've heard indigenous people refer the bear people, the bird people, the plant people, like those are people too, and we are the people with them, instead of the plants, the birds, the bears, and they're just like this other thing that's outside of us. While we stay in our fancy houses and watch them from game cams or whatever, but anyway. And my sense is that one of the reasons to perceive nature in that way is when you perceive it as people, it in your mind from a young age, if you're a young child, will see, oh, those are the rock people, tree people, also in what we call inanimate objects. Philosophically, you're embedding in that young person or in that young being that these are things that we share space with, that these are things that we live with, not something to just let's say bear people, you know, like a bear comes into your neighborhood and eats your garbage, okay? Like, that's reciprocity. I mean, that's something. He's more like a vagrant trying to dig through your trash, but let's say you're living on the land and the bear is eating berries in your area, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but just trying to give an image of what that means. And I think that we don't really know what any of that means. I think it's just this idea that sits, that people talk about. So, maybe an easier one is like a dog in our house, the reciprocity. We feed the dog gives us comfort. That's maybe an easier modern day one. There's probably better examples of reciprocity, but another one that's pretty simple with plants. Like, you know, if we're going to take from, grow a certain crop and the crop sucks out the, nutrients from the soil, you have to replenish the soil for the next crop or for the creatures that are there. So putting back nutrients into the soil, and that word would be called regenerative. So let me see. I guess the best way to describe it at this point is how we treat nature is we just treat it in an extractive way, not regenerative. So I'm going to extractive versus regenerative. We go into, let's say, a mountainous area, extract a bunch of iron, dig up, mine for things, mine for metals. Totally destroy the environment around that, and take the iron and don't give anything back to that area. And just leave it. And it becomes a super fun site. That's an example of a purely extractive process that Western culture has engaged in for a long time for the purpose of our technology, right? Advancement, advancement, advancement. Everybody knows about fossil fuels and how it, and then it pumping a bunch of fossil fuels into the air, creating more carbon problems, creating climate change, heating up the planet. Like, these are cycles that we have disrupted because of our extractive behavior, creating Superfund sites, the emissions issues. And then the amusing thing is we, through the industrial era, as they did this, they didn't think it'd be a feedback system that would affect us eventually, which now it is. And now this is what people have been talking about, you know, like the climate change problems, and now we're seeing the effects. So the perspective that started people down the wrong path originally was that we were separate from nature. That we were separate from these cycles. We were not a part of these cycles. These cycles didn't matter. And if we weren't going to suffer from them, the other poor people who got stuck in those areas, let's say mountaintop removal in Appalachia, have to drink that dirty water. They have to, like, live on that, and live near some of the Superfund sites. An example would be Copper Hill, Tennessee, where they mined the crap out of the copper there, and now there's, like, some kind of, like, a 40% cancer rate, and the mining has stopped, but the mine is still there. So, and it's not a coincidence that low-income peoples of all races and backgrounds get stuck in some of these places that are also polluted. So not only is there a component of, most people in Copper Hill, I think, are European Americans, but in other places, there's other races, people of color also end up living in some of the most polluted parts of the country. So this kind of extractive behavior doesn't really help us, and it doesn't help the most vulnerable, and it becomes a social justice issue and a race issue too. So this whole extractive thing that we've been living under is kind of a big problem. And I don't feel like I need to go off about it too much, because my sense is people already know about all that. So how are we going to fix it? Well, there's lots of ideas. There's this new word called regenerative. Regenerative that's been thrown around in agriculture. I think it's also been thrown around in social justice ways of how do we create a regenerative community and give back to the community, you know. Agriculture meaning regenerating the soil, not just, one example would be regenerating the soil, not just like planting a bunch of the same trees and like, or or a plant or monocrop and then it just sucks up all the nutrients out, but creating more permaculture type gardens, and agriculture is a better way of doing that, because when you have more diversity with plants in a agricultural setting, it mimics nature in a better way, and it's then the plants support each other when there's more diversity, as well as creating a doing types of crop rotation and types of nutrient replenishing when the soil has been used up, when the nutrients have been taken out of the soil. So people who work in permaculture and people who work in agriculture and regenerative agriculture, there's a lot of great ideas and practices that people are using now to try to do that. And in some of those places, it's super interesting. There's partnerships happening in like Central America, and slowly people are on a local level trying to do that around the world. So regenerative agriculture is growing. So as far as if it's supported by the mainstream, I don't know yet. Sometimes, you know, words get thrown around and they get used for, this is regenerative, but is it really? This is sustainable, or is it really? I don't know. you know, I hope there's checks and balances to really make sure that happens. But it seems like it's beginning in the collective mind of our planet and Western culture. So I just used agriculture as an example. There's also the word regenerative for our communities. So from a social justice perspective, you know, how do we support the less, you know, how do we support the less privileged in our communities? And doing that is by making an effort to focus on them and creating programs, and where obviously the privileged can put back some of their privilege into the system, which will help the less privileged. I mean, that would be ideal. And I imagine that there are programs like that around the country. I can't think of any right now, but taxes is one. That's an old school way. But, you know, nobody really knows what the Fed really does with their money. So we hope it goes in a good place. And we hope that some of those programs are doing good. And that they're not just happening on a federal level, but on local levels too. And lots of nonprofits around the country that are really trying to deal with some of these problems. So, you know, extractive versus regenerative, I feel like we're going in the right direction, but it's probably moving a little slow. So one of the ways I also sense, going back to Tyson Yacaporta and his book, he says, let's see, the book Sand Talk: How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. And I found the word reciprocity, the practice of exchanging things for others for mutual benefit, especially privileges granted by one country organization to another. So that concept of reciprocity is cross-cultural, and Tyson Yacaporta's book definitely goes in depth about it. But addressing our kin and our community, and seeing us as like not just an I in our individualist perspective, right, but more as a collective and a we. And the West is famous for having issues with the individualistic perspective. And I think it all begins with how we perceive, this whole reciprocity thing. How do we perceive nature? How do we perceive our nature? We are a part of nature. We're biological beings, right? So, it would be good to develop a better relationship with nature, and collect ideas that help lead us in this direction. Let's say, you know, going back to my son and his engagement with technology and all of our engagement with technology. Well, the screens and the plastics and all of the things that we're looking at come from the earth, and they're minerals that come from the earth. How do we recognize that as being part of nature? Why does there have to be a dualistic viewpoint? Oh, that's nature and this is technology, and, you know, where does that begin? Where does that end? Those connections. And it's really easy to forget that humans are a part of nature, because we're so good at manipulating environment. We're so good at making our houses warm, making our houses cold in the heat. And we have so much control over nature. How do you reconcile the fact that co-create with nature? So I just, you know, it seems like it's an ongoing practice to recognize. And I think of like old people, when their kids leave the house, probably what's gonna happen to me, they start gardening, they start having bird feeders around their house, they start, you know, not all of them, but some of them who like nature, they start getting more pets. And when we get, you know, to curb the loneliness of being old and home, and, you know, is there a reason for that? That do they see that blue jay that comes steals and squirrels that comes steal food out of the bird feeder. I mean, they become part of their community. I talk to my mom sometimes and she talks about the squirrels sometimes, and although she's not alone and old and all that, she still has stuff going on. She talks about the fox that showed up on her back porch, or the raccoon. So it's kind of interesting to recognize these things and just think about when we're young, little children love animals, and when we're really, really old, we start to go back to that too. And how do we lose it in between? So some people, you know, you can find nature in a city. You don't always have to go to a rural area. The grass that's growing between the correct sidewalk or the dandelions. My grandfather used to live in New York City, and he would collect dandelions and cook them in his house. And he was into the herbs and the... I mean, who knows if they were good or not, you know, because the freaking lead from the cars and stuff. But this was like the 50s. You know, nobody cared about that stuff back then. So how can we best engage with nature in a way that reminds us that we're part of nature and we recognize that we're part of nature? We can be, oh wow, how can I contribute back? And, you know, driving less, that's one thing. Having less garbage, that's another. But it seems that when people think about how they can be better, it involves this level of guilt and shame. And I sometimes think that guilt and shame comes from church. And not church in the good way, but church in the bad way. Like, oh, old guilt and shame of, like, we should be better, we should not do this. Kind of like this good-bad thing. Whereas if you just don't overthink it and try your best, maybe that creates less guilt and shame, and do it out of a sense of compassion. So let's see if I can find some amazing quote from Sandhawk, Tyson Yacaporta's book. His people in the beginning of the book, and he references animals and tales and just different, each chapter he uses different storytelling as a way to get his message across. So it's, yeah, he's but then he takes these various concepts that he creates these concepts out of the ideas. And just how we need to think about, let's see. So I'll just mention, he's got five symbols. All right. Kinship mind is a way of improving and preserving memory in relationships with others. I'm quoting Tyson Yacaporta here. If you learn something with or from another person, this knowledge now sits in relationship between you. You can access the memory of it best if you are together, but if you are separated, you can recall the knowledge by picturing the other person or calling out their name. This way of thinking and remembering is not limited to relationships with people. This symbol shows a connectedness between two things, places or people or knowledge or any combination of these, maybe even synapses. Two distinct entities form a pair connected by a relationship represented by the line at the center. Additionally, each entity is connected out to a multitude of other pairs. So the relationship is dynamic, responsive to shifting contexts. There is a tension and balance maintained between the individuality of each entity in each pair and their interdependence in a network of pairs. In Aboriginal worldviews, relationships are paramount in knowledge transmissions. There can be no exchange or dialogue until the protocols of establishing relationship have taken place. Who are you? Where are you from? Where are you going? What is your true purpose here? Where does your knowledge you carry from, and who shared it with you? What are the applications and potential impacts of this knowledge on this place? What impacts has it on other places? What other knowledge is related to, or who are you to be saying these things? In our world, nothing can be known or even exist unless it is in relation to other things. Critically, those things that are connected are less important than the forms of connection between them. We exist to form these relationships, which make up energy that holds creation together. When knowledge is patterned within these forces of connection, it's sustainable over deep time. So that is the first thing. He talks about kinship mind. He has other ones, let's see, which is a super powerful, well, information does not exist just as itself. It's connected to the relationship that it comes out of. I mean, imagine that if we actually thought about where our information came from and how we formed it and who's saying it. And what I noticed is our ideas and our culture are disembodied. They're not really connected to anyone or anything. I think of intellectual property when that comes up, but the ideas in this from his perspective belong to the community. They don't just belong to one person, and they're shared in the community. And which means, I was listening to him recently, and he said, you know, why didn't we have a discussion about CRISPR before someone even thought about inventing it and the effects it's going to ethically have on our culture? CRISPR is the genetic editing program that is really easy to get. I don't really know how easy it is to get, but it's seemingly accessible. A dangerous thing that affects human health and definitely human evolution, but it also can help. But somebody just in our culture, if it makes money, you just invent it, like, with no repercussions of thinking, oh my gosh, like, how is it going to affect us? And I think of the same way with our technology, like, how, you know, computers, was there any discussion on what this is going to do to our kids, or what this is going to do to our culture and the changes it's creating? And it clearly, you know, that does not, there's no discussion in our culture, it just happens. It's a top-down thing that just occurs. There's a new invention and somebody created it and it's spreading like wildfire and everybody's using it and we don't know or care how it's going to affect people. We're just going to make money. And, you know, now I'm going into the idea of extractive and how we have been extractive of the earth. We were extractive of information, and now we're extractive of humans because it's coming closer to home. That's, you know, a lot of the technology that we use, social media, data. Now we're extractive of the human experience, and that's what makes money. So, which is pretty scary, in a way, but, you know, I hope that humans can learn to overpower that and not completely just fall into habits with that. So, and when I mean extractive of the human experience, I mean all these legal battles over data and how big tech has been running our lives for the last, I don't know, probably 10 years and increasingly so, making us crazy. And it takes a lot of discipline and effort to disconnect. And when you disconnect, there's almost a loss. It's almost like you're disconnected from community. And unless someone has a strong social bond or group outside of social media or whatever, but there's a price to pay to disconnect, quote, from technology. Coming all around to, like, Tyson Yacaporta's idea of kinship mind and information and how, this is a way to preserve memory and relationships with others. He's a couple other ways talking about thinking and how we can reverse all this, but that's the start of description of how, if we can see knowledge as a relationship, and more than just the knowledge itself and the idea itself, but connecting it to who it's from and how it got here is what he's presenting. And if we were like, oh, who invented CRISPR? Thinking about that. And then who allowed it to exist? And when they got together, who was talking about it and how? And it sounds like gossip, but if we knew, you'd be like, huh, well, what were their intentions for inventing it? You know? Other concepts he has. Let's see. Kinship minds, about relationships and connectedness. Nothing exists outside of relationship to something else. So everything is related, instead of just by itself. Then there's story mind. The role of narrative and memory and knowledge transmission is the most powerful tool for memorization, particularly when connected meaningful to a place. This is how song lines have worked in Australia for millennia, to store knowledge in stories mapped in the land or reflected in the night sky. It includes yearning as a method of knowledge to production and transmission. Today, it is also about challenging grand narrative and histories. Well, that's interesting, because there's a lot of challenge going on with challenging Western history and the neoliberal model of looking at democracy. Now that people are looking back and on the African slave history in the U.S. and challenging that narrative, that's being changed for better, hopefully. The Australians, he's saying that the Australians had this strong, they're clearly an oral culture. They don't have written language, as many indigenous cultures. Many cultures around the world started out, and that's how a lot of indigenous cultures are. And they are able to orient themselves from one place to another based on song lines, and they sing the song of the place, and the place has certain foods in certain places, and then they start singing a song that's in their memory to another, and it leads them to the food for that season, and that's kind of how they survived as hunter-gatherers. I mean, that's my general knowledge of what's going on here, and he's taking that and turning it into a tool and a concept called story mind. So they're super fascinating people. They're pretty amazing how they have that tradition that they've had. So another one. This is the image of dreaming mind, which is all about using metaphors to work with knowledge. The circle on the left represents abstract knowledge, and the circle on the right represents tangible knowledge. The lines above and below represent communication between the physical and non-physical worlds, which occur through metaphors. These are images, dance, songs, language, culture, objects, ritual, gestures, and more. Feedback loops between the worlds must be completed with practical action. So, dreaming mind. Basically just saying that, like, metaphorical language is, and ideas probably aren't much of anything unless they're manifested into some practical action. A dance, a song, a ritual, language, objects. Otherwise, it's just an idea that floats up in the air, which our society worships abstract knowledge way too much. And I would say that computers, with what's on the computer, is very much abstract knowledge, and it feels like we're getting more and more abstract. We're getting more and more disembodied, like, to almost to the point where we're disembodied from the earth and going to space, just looking beyond our own bodies into, like, this other, the other place out there is much better, rather than sticking with being grounded. And this is a weird concept for, like, disassociation, because I do trauma work with people, and when you're disassociated, which a lot of people with history of PTSD off and on experience disassociation quite a bit throughout their day, which is a disconnect from their body, a disconnect from their experience, because it's too hard to be in the body and feel the reality of the really difficult and sad feelings and angry feelings from whatever bad experience they had. And I just feel that humans, Western culture, has been continually more and more disembodied from itself over time as we've gone into the modern times, the modern era. And this is I feel like I'm seeing this as more people get into VR and they get into the computer and the avatars, and that world is just so much more interesting than the real world. When we need to get back, where even regular, even people with minor trauma are becoming more disembodied. And I don't want to sound like super negative here, because there's also a lot of hope, but this computer technology can really take us out of the present experience and the real world. And when I think of kids, what skills do they need to learn to counteract these kinds of things? Like, what skills do they need to learn to be in the real world, to not just be lost in the screen and in technology, which is more and more infiltrating onto our experience as modern humans? So it's kind of scary. So, but I also trust that we're becoming more aware of this. So I think I'm starting to see more hope than I did like 6 months ago. So, but the disembodied abstract nature of our language and our experience in Western culture has seemingly been increasing more and more. And when you're people who, let's say I'll compare it to maybe the Aborigines of Australia. Like, what he's saying is when you don't have a lot of stuff and you don't have technology to help you and all the time, or I'll just say if you're like live in a place where you can't afford things, you kind of have to live in the real world more. And not that I don't know the class situation of the Aborigines in Australia. From what I understand, they're lower income and have a lot of struggle going on. And so, but even before Western culture came, they were able to exist without much technology at all. And that forced them to have to, look around where they're at in the environment, and engage with the environment more, because they didn't have those things. And this is kind of like getting into the whole idea of the noble savage thing. Native Americans supposedly had that as well. And every indigenous culture around the world had different elements of technologies that allowed them to exist and live a better life and whatnot. But overall, the more you have to live without technology, the more you're forced to live with what you have around you and figure out how to do that. And it forces you, I feel that it does force a more grounded existence on the planet. So if we could balance that out and teach kids, hey, maybe like learning to have a garden or farming or stuff like that, learning how to, I know this is what certain people are try to do with their kids, you know, sometimes just take them out of school and just teach them how to hunt and live off the land and stuff like that. And some people are successful probably doing that, and then others not so much. But it seems like there's a balance there that if we could just consistently remind ourselves that, you know, this is the earth, this is reciprocity with the earth, the more you get lost in your head and away from and into ideas that don't have any grounding and metaphors that don't have any grounding in an action or a fit or physicality, that we get further away from ourselves and further away from reality. So that was a long tangent, Jesus. Next one. This is an image for ancestor mind, which is about deep engagement, connecting with the timeless state of mind, or alpha wave state, or an optimal neural state for learning. We can reach this state through most Aboriginal cultural activities. It is characterized by complete concentration, engagement, and losing track of linear time. Ancestor mind can involve immersive visualization and extracognitive learning, such as revealed knowledge in dreams, inherited knowledge in cellular memory. So, he referred to alpha wave state, which is super interesting. So I'm guessing, and he says you can do that through most Aboriginal culture activities. So there's some sort of activities that those groups do that induce a trance-like state, I'm guessing, to Which creates deep engagement with a timeless sense of mind. Wow, super cool. I mean, it makes me think of lucid dreaming or hypnagogic states or anything when you're in a trance. Shamanic drumming probably does stuff like that. Dances, rigorous dances that, yeah, wow, that'd be super interesting to check out what, but this is a thing that many cultures have had in their past, is just cultural activities that induce trance-like states. And I see it as a way of like resting the brain, where you can access probably some deeper level of information or knowledge within yourself. So, which, you know, when you live in modern society, it's like all about the linear process, what facts, you know, like what's right there in front of you, like nothing, not very deep knowledge. Like this ancestor mind sounds like a reference to deep experiential knowledge, alpha wave state. So, pattern mind, which is about seeing entire systems and trends and patterns within them and using these to make accurate predictions and find solutions to complex problems. There are three lines with three sections. Each section represents the line from kinship mind symbol to two elements linked by a relationship. You can see that each new pair begins linked a new relationship. It is about truly holistic contextual reasoning. So once again, about relational reasoning and holistic reasoning. And all these concepts, pattern mind, ancestor mind, dreaming mind, kinship mind, and story mind are, quote, right brain things. It sounds like right brain stuff, where it's, you know, left brain's more of a logical, linear, cognitive type thinking, which is when you've got 5 minutes of a news flash and something tells you, oh, this is science and this is blah blah blah, like without any depth behind it, and that's immediately the only piece of information you retain for that fact, that does not constitute of enough mulling over or thinking of taking in that information and sitting with it and actually trying to understand. And right now, where we're at with all of our information, it's so fast. Our attention spans are short, which really only engages the linear mind, I think. And it doesn't give you enough time to actually sink in, what does it mean, this idea or this fact or this process? And then we move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And it's having attention span is one of the things that we're extracting our attention spans for sure in our Western culture, because they've run out of stuff to extract. So now they're doing humans. So, which is pretty creepy. And one of those things is our attention span, and that's pretty miserable and sad. So my hope is that, you know, as the pendulum swings, we start recognizing that, hey, my kid's attention span's not that great. And we need to take him off the screens. And yeah, I mean, my son's awesome. I know he's got a great sense of span, and he's learning a lot in school. And I think it's just a deeper sense of frustration of what I see these things do. And so this podcast is hopefully helping me with that. And I'm giving myself some of my own medicine. And just talking myself out of it, the stress. Sorry if I sound a little preachy, but you know, this, I just like sharing ideas, and that the, you know, our relationship, going back to reciprocity in our relationship to nature, to ourselves, to our technology, and just recognizing that this is all reciprocity means relational, basically. All this stuff is relational, and that's what Tyson Yucca-Porta is trying to say, that, you know, we were taught in our culture that, like, oh, everything's individualistic, and not connected. And I think, in my sense, is that's becoming a myth now that we've been told that, because we're seeing how we are connected in so many ways. And the only way we're really gonna grasp that is if we take the lens that we look through and take our core beliefs and deep down and really feel into what it means to be relational. What does it mean to be in reciprocity with someone or something? Oh, the other concept, other culture, cross-cultural concept, Aini. Is that, oh God, I'm gonna make a mistake here. A Hawaiian, I think, or Peruvian, one of those things, just like an exchange with the earth, that relational back and forth. Also, the Polynesians are famous for their potlatches, which is potluck. We took that word and culturally appropriated it, but it was some sort of event where they would take all of their things by a certain time of year and just like a flea market and give up those just... I don't know if it was exchange or barter, but they would just like put all their stuff and give it to the community that they didn't need. Just giving stuff. And, you know, I mean, I guess we can say Amazon is like that, but, and they would share it, and things were shared. And granted, you know, many of these communities were related, so it's easier for people to share with people who they knew, but, you know, sharing, reciprocity back to the community, give it back to the earth, give it back to your community, give it back to your family. Let's see what else. And just hope that this becomes something that grows. And Charles Eisenstein does a good job of taking the idea of interdependence and independence, and there's codependence and then there's independence. Independence is on a spectrum, right? Codependence, super enmeshed with a person. And then there's independence where you're just your own person and you have no connections. The best happy place is the middle, interdependence. And Charles Eisenstein discusses this, and I think in his podcasts and his books, and just how interdependence is a place that, you know, that involves these concepts of reciprocity and also indigenous concepts that Tyson Yacaporta shares. So, okay, there's my Sand Talk book promotion of Tyson Yacaporta's book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. And then, thank you for giving me a basis for some of this podcast. And then, just recognizing the difference between extractive and regenerative. Am I being extractive today or am I being regenerative today? And one more thing I wanted to mention, that I'm on a journey with this and in my life and with my business right now with this podcast, and I've been reading Alchemist, and the it basically just goes through how you just never know how your journey is going to turn out, and it's not about the destination, but it's about the process of the journey itself. So I've been inspired by that book lately. Anyway, okay, yep, thanks y'all for listening, me babbling, over and out, bye.